and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the furore over Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg's blunt remarks about Donald Trump that are seen as violating judicial ethics, but clearly represent her strong feelings as a citizen and a concerned American. We will explore the issues of professional ethics versus personal morality further and extend it into the field of journalism, where many journalists are just as alarmed at the prospect of a Trump presidency as Ruth Bader Ginsburg. But as the Republican nominee for president, will journalists afford Trump more dignity in his role as a GOP standard bearer and treat him as an equal on the stage with Hillary Clinton, and therefore take him more seriously as a candidate rather than judge him as a person? Gabriel Kahn, a professor of professional practice of journalism at the USC Annenberg School of Journalism, where he heads up the future of journalism project at the Annenberg Innovation Lab, joins us to discuss how journalists can be both objective and fair in their coverage of Trump without having to resort to the binary convention of balance and equivalence, whether false or not. Then we'll speak with Scott Kennedy, the Deputy Director of the Freeman Chair in China Studies at the Center for Strategic and International Studies and author of Beyond the Middle Kingdom. He joins us to discuss the explosion of nationalist fervor in China following the UN ruling against China's activities in the South China Sea, which has caused China's censors to work overtime online to curtail rallying cries for war. We will look into the backlash from the Chinese Communist Party's encouragement of nationalism as a way to legitimize its continuing rule, and how Xi Jinping will manage tensions created by China's assertion of rights that the UN has found to be baseless. Then finally, we examine the reaction to the UN ruling in the Philippines, where there appears to be a lot of celebrating, although the country's new and controversial president has had little to nothing to say. Joining us is Gerard Finan, who is the director of the Pacific Islands Development Program at the East-West Center in Hawaii, where his area of expertise includes public policy, social change, development, and urbanization in the Philippines. We will discuss whether this moral victory will translate into any practical gains for the Philippines. And joining us now is Gabriel Kahn, who's a professor of professional practice of journalism at the USC Annenberg School of Journalism, where he heads up the Future of Journalism project at the Annenberg Innovation Lab. He has worked as a newspaper correspondent and editor for two decades, including 10 years at the Wall Street Journal, where he served as Los Angeles Bureau Chief, Deputy Hong Kong Bureau Chief, and Deputy Southern European Bureau Chief based in Rome. He has reported from more than a dozen countries on three continents. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gabriel Kahn.
Hi, Ian. Thank you.
And there's clearly a lot of a bit of a flap caused by Ruth Bader Ginsburg's remarks, which she clearly were deliberate because she made them to the New York Times and then to the AP and then on CNN. So there's no question that she, these weren't slip of the tongue, where she lamented the very existence of Donald Trump in the American political scene and even made a joke about moving to New Zealand. So I'd be interested in talking to you about, we know in the law there's a very good reason why justices are supposed to be completely independent and immune from political statements like that, even if they feel strongly about issues. And there are obviously good reasons for it in the judiciary. But how does it work in journalism in the sense that more and more, I think Donald Trump, as he becomes the nominee and the candidate for the second party in our two-party system, is he more or less being dignified by the very position he had? And journalists who have problems about him, who have qualms about him, who are still troubled by what he said, and those, of course, that he's even banned from covering him, etc., put them in Ruth Bader Ginsburg's shoes. And as much as, how do you be honest with yourself and honest with your readers?
Well, I think that you've got sort of two very different situations here with Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who represents an institution that has, you know, a very specific responsibility and role in this context, and then the press. And I think that what people expect of the press, of course, is some type of honest and fair reporting on an issue. I think that's different than what we sometimes think of as objectivity, which kind of represents, in some, as others have termed it, the view from nowhere. Certainly, Donald Trump presents tremendous kind of challenges to the press because he has broken so many of the rules of polite discourse in campaigning and so forth. I think that the responsible way to approach this on the part of the press is to treat it with fairness, but to not sort of shelve anyone's point of view to the extent that it becomes an issue of equivocation, because I think the views of press expressed by Donald Trump frequently, you know, do go beyond the pale and need to be reported as such. And, you know, whether he has the official mantle of the party nominee or not, I don't think that that responsibility changes, you know, one whit on the part of the press.
But don't you think going forward it will essentially be, and Hillary Clinton said this and Donald Trump said that, is that, you know...
Certainly there's a lot of, you know, knee-jerk reaction. A lot of this is just sort of journalistic convention of how people report on these things, that yes, there's always going to be a certain amount of he said, she said. And to some extent, you know, if I were covering this campaign on a daily basis, you know, I would definitely want to include their competing remarks. That doesn't mean that I want to place a remark about banning Muslims from the U.S. or something like that on par with something with a much more anodyne comment from, you know, his political rival. I think that when statements, you know, sort of break new ground in terms of their incivility or things like that, it is the responsibility of the press to note that and to put that in the proper context.
So when you talk about objectivity in the press, it does seem to be confused with this idea, this binary notion that there, in the universe of discourse, there's two equal and opposite positions, and that you essentially are in a position where you have to present both sides, even if you believe that there's a false equivalence. Or I guess the reductio absurdum of that argument would be that if you interview a Holocaust survivor, you're therefore obliged to interview a Holocaust denier. You don't see that tradition binding the press in this election race?
Well, I'm sure that there's going to be plenty of practice during the course of the coverage of the campaign that sort of falls back on that. I would think of that being inappropriate when the subject at hand is, you know, is something that has, again, kind of broken the norms of you know, normal sort of discourse. And I think it's incumbent upon the press to note that and to contextualize it so that, you know, the audience also understands that this is not something that is that this doesn't fit into that typical binary pattern, that this is not simply, you know, a horse race or a ball game, that there should be the, you know, it should be duly noted when one candidate basically takes incivility to a new level.
And again, I'm speaking with Gabriel Kahn. He's a professor of professional practice of journalism at the USC Annenberg School of Journalism, where he heads up the Future of Journalism project at the Annenberg Innovation Lab. He has worked as a newspaper correspondent and editor for two decades, including 10 years at the Wall Street Journal, where he served as Los Angeles Bureau Chief, Deputy Hong Kong Bureau Chief, and Deputy Southern European Bureau Chief based in Rome. And he's reported from more than a dozen countries on three continents. So, give me a sort of sense of what you mean then, Gabriel Kahn, about objectivity. Because, you know, I was trained at the BBC where, you know, you're allowed to have your own opinions. You can't sort of try and be a monk or the piano player in the whorehouse. And as long as you're sort of fair and honest, in other words, it's the assumption is that it's more honest to reveal your biases as opposed to try to hide them.
Well, listen, we also have an evolving media landscape here where this notion of sort of objectivity, which reigned in the U.S. for half a century, has now gone on the wane for many reasons, because we have so many new competitors in the business of reporting the news. You know, we used to have three networks nationally, and then pretty much each major market had one newspaper. Well, when you've got that type of market domination, you're going to get a lot of sort of bland, you know, very sort of straightforward coverage as a result. Now that you have so many different players, even in the world of, you know, 24-hour cable news or something like that, each one is forced to distinguish itself, and they do that by taking a political bent very often. So, you know, we also have, again, sort of a media field that has, you know, changed so much because there's so many more participants and they're all competing for a certain segment of the audience. So, but what you said earlier about, I mean, as a reporter, I would expect anybody that I'm following here to be fair. That is, if, you know, I wouldn't want that person to take out of context a snippet of something that a candidate said simply because it seems incendiary. I would like to know the full context, and I think that's a part of being fair. However, if that full context is, you know, disturbing, inappropriate, incites people to violent actions, et cetera, I would want that reporter to, you know, to report that out fully and explain the implications to me.
Well, it seems that the convention of the binary equal and opposite arguments comes out of the fact that the newspaper owners recognized that half their readers were Democrats and half their readers were Republicans, and rather than offend one half of their readers, they decided on this, on the one hand, on the other hand, approach. So, but how much do you think the lines are being blurred between news and opinion by this new journalism, particularly by these 24-hour cable shows, even though they do sort of occasionally have a little bit of news? 90% of the time, it's process and opinion.
Sure.
And, you know.
Well, I mean, there's a market-driven reason as to why they've gone to that. And that has taken place, you know, as America has become much more polarized around these issues, too. And the way in which we consume media, whether it is, you know, simply running to our corner by whomever you choose to as your cable news provider, or the way people live in these filter bubbles, you know, on Facebook or other social media, where they are, the way that these algorithms function is to reinforce, you know, preferences to the point where you're just not exposed to competing points of view. So something that I would consider to be completely from outer space might seem fairly normal to someone else because it's being reinforced so often from all of this person's social graph. That has implications for the way that people vote, the way that people feel, and the level of the frequency with which politicians now express essentially extreme positions that then feel that they get an echo in the media landscape.
Well, but this suggests that if people more and more do what's referred to as reality shopping, where they want their own positions reinforced, you know, you have Fox catering to the right wing, MSNBC to the left wing, Christian broadcasters to Christians, and at the end of the day, where would the consensus be about what is real anymore? What is the truth? I mean, you essentially...
So that's really the... I think the tremendous responsibility that anybody in the press has right now with all of this stuff, that you can be opinionated and be insightful. I follow plenty of journalists who have very strong opinions, yet they also are able to articulate those in a way that can be quite compelling. But I think that you're right in that one of the big casualties that we have here, particularly in this campaign, are facts, right? And that those are somehow negotiable or variable, depending on you know, whom you're speaking to the point where, you know, we have the presumptive Republican nominee making references about, you know, how Vince Foster was murdered or something like that. And, you know, you repeat these things long enough, it doesn't make it true, but for many people it makes it sort of acceptable. And I think this is really, I think, one of the big crises that the profession of journalism is facing in this environment, in that there are so many voices that facts themselves can seem malleable. And this requires an ethical code to follow. And, you know, what you said before, is people sort of reality shopping, don't forget that that's exacerbated because of the nature of the way that we receive so much of our news now over social media, that it's not just that people are reality shopping, it's that everybody, that your normal behavior on Facebook will lead you to reality shopping, whether that's your intent or not.
So are we then heading into a landscape where he who spins the truth best wins the argument?
Well, I guess you could say that to a certain extent we've always been in that environment. What you might have had differently was a press corps that at different times in our history was more or less aggressive about ferreting that out. What we have now is certainly just this fractured notion, I think, is the difference here, that I live in one area of Los Angeles where I would bet pretty much that all of my neighbors more or less are in the same realm as I am in terms of how we perceive this political election. And there can be other neighborhoods, probably not even far from here, where people have a completely different view of the campaign.
So when the Huffington Post first started to deal with Donald Trump, they wanted to relegate him to the entertainment pages, but that proved to be somewhat farcical, I guess, in a way, because he became such a juggernaut in these debates. But then since then, they have a disclaimer at the bottom saying, reminding everybody, this guy is a xenophobe and said all these terrible things about Latinos and Muslims, etc. So since you teach young journalists journalistic standards and the professional practice of journalism, what kind of advice do you give prospective and upcoming journalists in terms of how they can both accommodate their own feelings, and in the case of Donald Trump, he certainly does elicit some pretty strong feelings, at the same time do objective coverage?
Well, I mean, first, just to make a reference to the Huffington Post decision, I mean, I think that showed the classic kind of arrogance on the part of the press that they also misread the mood of the public. And for, a press organ to relegate this person to the entertainment coverage proved to be evidence of how out of touch this press organ was, because this message resonated so heavily with such, with a plurality of Republican primary voters. But to answer your question about sort of how to behave, I mean, I would say, and I don't necessarily think that this is always the case, but I mean, certainly, absolutely, 100% now, the sort of verification of facts, the ability to hold both candidates accountable to, the factual basis of what they are saying is more important than ever. And I think if we lose touch with that, then we're all just sort of floating in a sea here and we have no moorings. I think that different players have tried to sort of adjust to that with Donald Trump, where it can be so challenging to check these facts as they sort of spew out of his mouth, that the CNN, for example, has resorted to sort of fact-checking him in the Chyron, that sort of scroll text that goes underneath, that goes at the bottom of the screen as people are talking, simply because it's almost impractical for the interviewer to stop him at every turn to either check the facts or challenge his statements. So that to me is really the most important thing that we have to sort of start with and hold on to.
Well, just in closing then, the idea of the 18th century enlightenment has always been that if you present the facts, you sort of settle the argument, that there's an assumption, that somehow that intelligence and reason prevails, as opposed to this sort of emotional intelligence that people, first of all, after all, Donald Trump's new manager is a PR guy, Manafort, and Karl Rove has also shown how to run a campaign and how to use the half-truths and whatever to extraordinary advantage. So just in closing, I'm trying to get a sense here of whether this very notion of enlightenment as a result of reductive logical thinking, etc., which is sort of the intellectual tradition, if you will, whether that is antiquated and that this new form of emotional intelligence is the future?
Well, I would disagree with that, because I think that if you really do take sort of a sweep of history, that there have been plenty of instances, certainly in the past century, where appealing to one's emotions, massaging facts, overemphasizing certain parts of it, I mean, has been the staple of political campaigning to great success. And so I don't think that that's new. I think that what's a little bit different here is that it is so easy to find a corner of the media that will echo that, repeat that, to sort of create some type of a legitimacy around that. I think that's a little bit easier right now than it has been in the recent past. But what you're talking about certainly has, you know, you could look at the Spanish-American War in 1898 or something like that, and the way that the press appealed to people's emotions was, you know, certainly, you know, very visceral and to great effect as well.
Well, Gabriel Kahn, I thank you very much for joining us.
Sure. My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Gabriel Kahn, who's a professor of professional practice of journalism at the USC School of Journalism, where he heads up the Future of Journalism Project at the Annenberg Innovation Lab. He has worked as a newspaper correspondent and editor for 2 decades, including 10 years at the Wall Street Journal, where he served as Los Angeles Bureau Chief and Deputy Hong Kong Bureau Chief and Deputy Southern European Bureau Chief based in Rome. And he's reported from more than a dozen countries on 3 continents. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into the explosion of nationalist fervor in China following the UN ruling against China's activities in the South China Sea.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No short head.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Scott Kennedy, who's the Deputy Director of the Freeman Chair in China Studies and Director of the Project on Chinese Business and Political Economy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He has written extensively about U.S.-China relations, and his latest book is Beyond the Middle Kingdom, and he has a new report at CSIS, Perfecting China, Inc. Welcome to Background Briefing, Scott Kennedy.
Good to talk to you.
And it seems that the Chinese leadership is now somewhat worried about this nationalist backlash, which they have always encouraged. The assumption has always been that the Chinese Communist Party, after Tiananmen Square, have decided to push nationalism and, you know, try and get the young Chinese to forget about democracy, etc. And they've been very successful in creating a kind of nationalist fervor. And now that the UN tribunal has ruled against China for its claims over the South China Sea, apparently the Chinese, within China itself, there's some really angry Chinese nationalists, to the point now that China's censors online are censoring people who are calling for a war. I guess I don't know who they want to go to war against, because I guess the Chinese government's propaganda is more or less implied that it's not really the Philippines behind this. It's the hidden hand of the Americans and the Japanese.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, I think you're right that the Chinese government has stoked nationalism for a long time. Certainly, the whole idea behind China's rejuvenation and the achievement of the China Dream is the idea that since the mid 19th century, China was mistreated by Western powers. Had a semi-colonial status, and 1949, when the CCP came into power and formed the People's Republic, was the end of that century of humiliation. And now China's rising again, and it should be inevitable. And anyone standing in their way is standing in the way of history. And certainly, this case fits that in that story. And certainly the U.S. has often been pointed to as the instigator trying to keep China down.
So in reviving all of this history, and all of which is true, you know, the Opium Wars, etc., the idea that China was a victim of Western exploitation, and the idea of bringing that back at this moment, again, this is a dispute with largely with the Philippines and by extension Vietnam, who've sort of signed on, if you will, as a kind of friend of the court. Obviously, there's a tremendous disparity between the Chinese military and, as far as I know, the Philippine military is all but non-existent. They don't even have an operational jet fighter anymore, and their navy is rusting. So how is this going to translate then in the future? I guess the first question I'd ask, though, is if things are going to get more and more tense between the U.S. and China in this neighborhood.
Sure.
My understanding is that American oil companies have explored for oil in the region, can't find any. So what if they're not after oil, what are the Chinese after? I mean, why create this kind of atmosphere of belligerence?
Sure.
What's your understanding of their real motives?
Sure. So let me just make a very brief comment first about the historical issue. China did suffer intrusions at the hands of Western powers from Europe in the Opium War and later in the 19th century and early 20th century from Japan. But China was never fully colonized to the extent that other countries in Africa and other places in Asia were. And a lot of the problems that China suffered at the end of the Qing Dynasty in the first half of the 20th century are more domestically caused than the consequence of China's foreign relations. That was more that was as much an outcome of the problems that China had domestically as the reverse. So not to say that not to clean the hands of Western powers for what they did, but nevertheless it's a more complex historical story than often is portrayed. In terms of right now, I think beside the hydrocarbons that may be underneath the South China Sea or may not, or the other types of mineral and resources, what you do have, I think, of prime importance for the Chinese is a national security concern and to see the South China Sea as a buffer that they can place between themselves and the American Navy and the Navy from Japan. China's primary security weaknesses are not over land anymore. They're primarily on its east and southern coast, and so that's number one for them, creating maritime depth. You then have just simply the view, this historical view, which may be partly constructed, but I think a lot of people in China believe it, that the rejuvenation of China and the unification of China and territorial integrity on land and sea is part of ending that 200 or 100 year period, and so you've got both economics but also security and issues of national identity all rolled up into this case.
And again, I'm speaking with Scott Kennedy. He's the Deputy Director of the Freeman Chair in China Studies and the Director of the Project on Chinese Business and Political Economy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He's written extensively about U.S.-China relations, and his latest book is Beyond the Middle Kingdom, and he has a new report at CSIS, Perfecting China, Inc. So to the question of, or to the assumption that the Chinese Communist Party uses nationalism as a way to sort of legitimize itself, and that perhaps it may have gotten out of hand a little bit with lots of Chinese online calling for China to go to war. I'm still not quite clear about who they want to go to war against. Do you have any sense of that?
I don't. The internet is a place where a lot of different voices emerge in every country, including in the United States, if you look at the comments on the internet and things. And we know that that's a very boisterous place. Very little of it translates into policy or genuine pressure that the U.S. government feels. And I think the same is in China. Even though people march in the streets, even though you've got folks on small vessels going out into the South China Sea or East China Sea in the case of the disputes with Japan or protesting online, I think at the end of the day, this is still going to be decisions that are made independently by Xi Jinping, the people around him, the Chinese military. And this is a lot of noise, a lot of attention, and I think sometimes it's worth paying attention to, but I don't think it's going to be determinative of what Chinese policy is going to be.
So is this in any way an indicator that the Chinese Communist Party is nervous. I mean, under Xi Jinping, it seems like he's rolled back the clock on private and public expression. He's been heavy on censorship. He told the press that their job was for propaganda primarily.
Yes.
It's pretty clear that he is sort of harking back to Mao in many ways, even though him and his father was, I think, was a general, was purged.
Yes.
So it's pretty hard for me to understand why he's coming across as a kind of Maoist, given what happened to his family during the Cultural Revolution, and of course to many of the families, including Deng Xiaoping's family, his own son was tossed out of a sixth floor building and was in a wheelchair for the rest of his life. So they all have scars from the Cultural Revolution, but somehow it looks like she's trying to take him back to the Cultural Revolution.
Yeah, I can understand that, and that's a conversation that occurs in China quite a bit. I would say that to some extent, we definitely see a rolling back of the clock or moving in a direction which we didn't expect under Xi Jinping. And really, the hallmark of his leadership is the idea of control, control over the economy, over civil society groups, over Chinese foreign policy in the neighborhood around China, exerting much more control. And certainly those, it's consistent across the board. I do think what's different from the Cultural Revolution, and there are a lot of things that are different, is that Mao called on people to come out to participate in public life, to protest, to overthrow the bureaucracy. And, you know, there were millions marching in Beijing and Tiananmen Square and elsewhere during the Cultural Revolution. Universities overturned. China broke diplomatic relations with almost everybody. And under Xi Jinping, it's really the opposite, right? It's he does not want to generate a lot of public participation. He is a pseudo-populist, and limiting participation, squelching participation of civil society, independent activity is definitely a hallmark of his campaign, and that's very different from the way things were under Mao.
So some of the stuff that's being even discussed both on the internet and even in the Chinese media is fairly sort of insulting to the Filipinos, and the fact that the China is sort of occupied Scarborough Shoal, which is just 100 miles west of the Philippines, is pretty extraordinary in itself. One of the comments here that from Weibo is, does the Philippine island want to become Philippines province? Those who sell bananas should keep selling bananas. Don't keep concerning yourselves with my fish. that's pretty extraordinary, and bringing the United States with you won't work. So, I mean, we know that China has fished out most of its waters and it's moving south, and it's obviously competing now with the Filipinos and the Vietnamese and the Indonesians for their own domestic fish requirements. So, but the idea that, you know, the Filipinos export their bananas to China, so that's what they're referring to. You know, you stick to your bananas, but don't eat our fish.
Well, I think something to keep in mind is this tension in China between, on the one hand, wanting equality, wanting China to not be treated as a colony, as a second-class member of the global community, wanting their say in the world, which they've been pushing and I think achieved. On the other hand, being recognized as a great power, as one of the preeminent powers in the world, and therefore having a little bit more say than others. And I think that chip on China's shoulder makes them, at least in the type of things that we've been hearing, but also you've seen that in public statements that Chinese officials have said when they've been in meetings with officials from Southeast Asia, is looking down upon these smaller players who they don't seem to respect as much. And that's a problem. And so the ruling really puts this front and center. It's a ruling that says, even if you're a big, powerful country like China, smaller countries like the Philippines can also use this system to their advantage. And that's, there's a lot of, in UNCLOS, which is good for China. Maybe not some of the specific rulings yesterday, but a lot of UNCLOS is important to China. And so we hope that China can figure out how to resolve this tension that it's had. Because it's really important for China's national interests. And, you know, it's not just about fish and bananas. China's economy and the global economy run on a lot more than that. And, you know, everyone's going to have to get used to that.
And, of course, UNCLOS is the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, to which China is a signatory. So, but it seems to me that, you know, with Obama's pivot to Asia and the TPP, which has sort of survived the Democratic platform fight, and it's very much a product of Hillary Clinton's work as Secretary of State. So isn't that sort of inherently about the idea that the more China flexes its muscles, the more it alarms the neighborhood, the more the U.S. figures that we're better off organizing the neighborhood against China and into a kind of trading bloc?
Sure. It could evolve in that direction where it's much more confrontational and U.S. activities are simply organized around the principle of balancing against China. But I think the Obama administration's motive and their starting point is that a successful China, a powerful China, a globally powerful China isn't necessarily inconsistent with U.S. interests or in the globe or in Asia, as long as China plays by the rules that everyone has accepted, including China. And so these territorial issues that China has with its neighbors need to be resolved in a peaceful way without intimidation and by the rules that all of them have agreed to, including UNCLOS. And so, however China and the other claimants resolve those, whoever says who has which islands, I don't think the U.S. actually has a stake in that, as long as they do it in a way that everyone can accept and doesn't affect commerce and trade that goes through the South China Sea. And I think that applies to many other issues as well. Now, it may be that the strategy eventually translates or works its way out into a way which is really just about balancing against China, but that's certainly not the intention. And so far, it isn't necessarily acting that way, even though the Chinese frame it as the U.S. Trying to contain them and causing mischief.
Well, of course, Mischief Reef was the one part of the Spratlys that was mentioned, where the Chinese have built a base and the U.S. has responded to that by having their warships go by, and that's infuriated the Chinese. So already we've had some confrontation, and I would think that this ruling by the UN buttresses the position of the U.S. and Japan and South Korea and the Philippines. So we will see, I guess, Scott, whether this will lead to more tension or less.
We certainly will. I think Mischief Reef is probably appropriately named, because not only for the reasons that you just stated, but in the ruling yesterday, there in the section on the determination of the status of various features, Mischief Reef was identified as not being an island that could naturally sustain human life, only a rock, and therefore not, it doesn't deserve an EEZ around it, or even a 12 nautical mile protections. And in fact, they said it fell within the Philippines continental shelf. So it doesn't belong to China. And so by being within the Philippine continental shelf, it belongs to the Philippines. It was the one area where the ruling made a decision on sovereignty, even though it wasn't supposed to be a case about sovereignty. The Chinese occupy that, and supposedly belongs to the Philippines. That's the only case in the decision. That's going to, you know, who's going to be asking the Chinese to leave Mischief Reef? And what is the Chinese answer going to be?
We know what that's going to be based upon what they've said about the whole deal. I thank you for joining us, Scott Kennedy.
Good talking to you, Ian.
Likewise. And again, I've been speaking with Scott Kennedy, who's Deputy Director of the Freeman Chair in China Studies and Director of the Project on Chinese Business and Political Economy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He's written extensively about U.S.-China relations, and his latest book is Beyond the Middle Kingdom, and he has a new report at CSIS, Perfecting China, Inc.
Nung isilang ka sa mundong ito, laking tuwa ng magulang mo at ang kamay nilang iyong ilaw. At ang nanay at tatay mo'y di malaman ang gagawin.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Gerard Finnan, who's a director of Pacific Islands Development Program at the East-West Center in Hawaii, where his area of interests include public policy, social change, development, and urbanization in the Philippines. He is the author of The New Pacific Way, Gambling on a Gambler, High Stakes for the Philippine Presidency. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gerard Finnan.
Very good to be with you, Ian.
And what is the local reaction in the Philippines to the ruling in their favor by the UN tribunal, ruling against China in favor of the Philippines in this very important case over Chinese expansion into the South China Sea and right up to the Scarborough Reef, which is about 100 miles to the west of the Philippines itself? There seems to be a disconnect between the new president of the Philippines, who has a very muted response, and the people of the Philippines who are rejoicing that justice has been meted out.
Well, as you suggest, there has been some jubilation, I guess one could say. There has been some public sentiments suggesting that this victory is a victory for the Philippine people, in both the short term and the long term. I'm not convinced that's necessarily the case. I think it's important to remember that initially the case was filed after the Philippine government felt it had run out of options. And there were voices in the Philippines that said, in view of the David versus Goliath nature of the dispute, that it was unwise for the Philippines to be the first country to challenge China in the international court, the UN Permanent Tribunal. There was the suggestion that this was too provocative, and in any case, there would be no way for the court to enforce its decision. Others said that the legal case was a bad idea because it was likely the permanent tribunal would not be sufficiently decisive in its judgment, that the jurists would look for a compromise that would be unhelpful to the Philippines. Today, it's apparent that the permanent tribunal has spoken with a clear and unanimous voice. And I think the key thing is the court of public opinion internationally is going to be placing the onus on China to explain why it has taken aggressive steps to assert unilateral control over areas such as the Scarborough Shoals. These, of course, were traditionally fished cooperatively by citizens of numerous countries, including Chinese fishers. And so it's changed the balance in a certain sense. Going to your question about the reaction of Filipinos, certainly there are nationalist sentiments that are running high at this point in time. But I think the Philippine government, the Duterte administration, realizes they need to continue their dialogue and they need to continue the commercial engagement with China. So that's also an important point. The other thing that comes to mind is the decision comes at a time when this new president, President Rodrigo Duterte, who was not the person who initially brought the case, that was brought during the years of President Aquino, and he's only recently been sworn into office. So he projects a no-nonsense sort of tough guy image, which may, in fact, give him more latitude or political space to negotiate with the Chinese. And so I think that's part of the reason for a more muted response. Filipinos will trust their president to strike a hard bargain. He's not seen as someone who's a pushover by any means. So that's sort of the sense, I think, domestically in the Philippines. Now, the Chinese may be more comfortable negotiating with Duterte because he's seen as a Philippine president who is more independent than his predecessor and less likely to be directly influenced by American foreign policy. So all of this may suggest there'll be fewer confrontations and incidents in the months ahead. I think, speaking realistically, of course, China is unlikely to dismantle the military infrastructure it has built or allow Southeast Asia fishers into the reef or other areas where they've built infrastructure. But because the Duterte administration did not initiate this case, they may be in a better position to negotiate a peaceful resolution over the long term. You know, short term, I don't think all that much is going to change. The other side of it that's a victory for the Filipino people is they've won, I think, greater respect from their Southeast Asian neighbors who also have claims in the South China Sea.
And again, I'm speaking with Gerard Finnan, who's the director of the Pacific Islands Development Program at the East-West Center in Hawaii, where his areas of interest include public policy, social change, development, and urbanization in the Philippines, and is the author of The New Pacific Way, Gambling on a Gambler, High Stakes for the Philippine Presidency. Well, in terms of what leverage the Philippines may have, and I must say that there are rumors that the new president, Duterte, is influenced by Chinese investments and business, some of which may end up in his pocket. I don't know whether those rumors can be proven at this point, but it's pretty clear that the Philippines essentially don't have an air force anymore. I don't believe that they have one operational jet fighter. Their navy has been allowed to sort of rust. So there's no military leverage that they have over China's militarization of the South China Sea. And the Chinese have already said that the Philippines' claims are baseless and an act of bad faith. And the Chinese vice foreign minister said on whether China will set up an air defense zone over the South China Sea, what we have to make clear first is that China has the right to do so. But whether we need one in the South China Sea depends on the level of threats we face. So this is, you refer to it as a David and Goliath situation. It's even worse than that, isn't it? With a powerful Chinese military up against essentially the Philippine government has allowed its military to essentially rot into non-existence.
Well, as you suggest, and I think as Al McCoy said yesterday on your program quite correctly, the military option is not on the table, and it never has been on the table. And even if the Philippine government were to rapidly and massively expand its expenditure for military equipment and training, it would essentially be a futile task. So I think the armed forces of the Philippines leadership takes a very realistic view of this in saying that they have a quite limited role, regardless of what kind of funding they receive.
But is this likely to have the Philippine government reconsider its relationship with the U.S., having kicked the U.S. out some time ago from these massive bases at Subic Bay and Clark Airfield, etc., since they have not made the investments in their military? Would they be more inclined now to invite the U.S. in, since China is basically, I wouldn't suggest that they're saber-rattling, but the statement from the vice foreign minister more or less is saying, you know, if we want to, we can, set up an air umbrella over this entire area, and that in itself would be pretty aggressive.
Well, of course, the U.S. has a long-standing treaty relationship with the Philippines, and that continues. There are also various agreements that have been negotiated in recent years to allow the rotation of U.S. troops for training and other maneuvers in the Philippines. That continues. However, it is a time of reassessment with a new administration, and I think both sides are sort of sizing each other up, and Mr. Duterte is very much unlike his predecessors in terms of his perspective on the United States. So it remains to be seen to what extent this relationship with the U.S. will prosper. However, that could actually work, as I suggested, to the benefit of the Philippines if their more independent posture is seen as something that China looks favorably upon. And so China may be willing to take a new look at its relationship with the Philippines as well, in both bilateral and commercial terms.
So what is then the difference in Duterte's attitude to the United States? When you say he's more independent, is it this a result of the general disquiet that the U.S. and the press have had at this, the idea of this guy who boasts about raping women and wished he would have raped that Australian woman who was gang raped and died, and then he's already claimed, I think he's personally killed over 1,000 people. So what has been the U.S. attitude? I mean, clearly this is a troubling kind of character to be a head of state. So is he acting more or less like, if you guys don't like me, screw you? What is his actual attitude to the United States, do you know?
Well, in the past, he has certainly been seen as a voice that has been willing to criticize the U.S. in ways that most Filipino politicians would not. And there has certainly been a cautious approach by the United States, recognizing that he was legally elected to be the president of the Philippines, but looking to see what kind of leadership he's going to provide as president, which of course is far different from being the mayor of a single city. So I think it's been a cautious wait-and-see attitude on the part of the United States. Duterte doesn't perhaps have the same experiences in the U.S. or the same understanding of our culture and traditions, and he may be more of a nationalist than some of his predecessors, like Mr. Aquino or Mr. Ramos. So all of that suggests that from the Chinese perspective, he may be seen in a more favorable light, and they may see him as someone that they can talk to in a way that they couldn't speak with some of his predecessors. Having said that, of course, many of his cabinet members, including his new foreign minister, Mr. Yasai, have extensive experience in the United States, and so they understand the foreign policy apparatus here. They understand the pivot that was discussed at some length yesterday on your program. And so from that perspective, I think we'll have to wait and see just how the relationship develops between the new administration and Washington, as well as between the new administration and Beijing. And I think up to this point, President Duterte has wisely been holding his cards close to his chest.
But previously, of course, he said with great bravado that I'll get on a jet ski and I'll go out. I guess he was referring to the Scarborough Shoal, which is about 100 miles west of the Philippines.
That's right.
And I will basically take on the Chinese myself and plant the Filipino flag. It seems that the people so far that are losing out are the Filipino fishermen. And also there's clashes between Chinese fishermen and Indonesian fishermen as well. And as Al McCoy pointed out yesterday, there's about over 90,000 Chinese fishing vessels that are essentially organized under the Chinese Navy. So what's happening with the fishing lobby in the Philippines? Are they demanding action from their government?
Well, it's interesting you mention that. Late last year, I was in a place called Masinloc in the province of Zambales, and many of those fishers had traditionally gone out to the Scarborough Shoals in order to spend, you know, weeks fishing and bringing back fish for not only their families but for commercial purposes. But these were small-scale fishers, and they talked at length about the good relationship they had with Chinese fishers traditionally, and how there was an ethos of sharing and a reciprocity that they found to be very worthwhile. That's, of course, all changed now with the presence of the Chinese Coast Guard. But I think it's very unlikely that at this point those fishers are going to be able to avail of the fishing grounds that they have traditionally had access to. Having said that, you know, they probably feel some small sense of pride in knowing that the International Tribunal has ruled in favor of the Philippines. But on a day-to-day basis, it won't change very much.
So just in closing then, is your sense that the, first of all, I understand that U.S. oil companies have said that there's really not any oil there, and that's always been the assumption. In fact, the Law of the Sea ruling from the UN Tribunal mentioned resources, as which sounded like they were referring to oil. So if there's no oil there, it's very hard to understand what the Chinese motives are. I mean, it's sort of, you know...
Well, clearly there's a geostrategic motive. You know, the Chinese government is aware of U.S. history. They're aware of how Hawaii was acquired, Guam, they're certainly also aware of the fact that they see the South China Sea as historically part of their domain. I think the key question at this point is whether the decision will influence Chinese decision makers in a manner that suggests more confrontation and more incidents, or whether they'll decide to sort of try to maintain the status quo, not back off, but at the same time not take more aggressive action in light of the changing international view of their situation in the South China Sea. I mean, this is a very significant case indeed, and one that will have long-term implications for international relations and long-term implications for how China is viewed by their Southeast Asian neighbors.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Gerard Finnan.
Always good to talk with you, Ian. Thank you.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Gerard Finnan, who's director of the Pacific Islands Development Program at the East-West Center in Hawaii, where his area of interest include public policy, social change, development, and urbanization in the Philippines. And he's the author of The New Pacific Way, Gambling on a Gambler, High Stakes for the Philippine Presidency. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.